The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com, that is gsuggsinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated March 24, 2025, bordered in red as usual. The front cover includes a narrow white inner border. Time is in large block capital lettering, barely visible. It's in a dark bluish gray, superimposed upon a darker blue-black background. There's a rearing horse in the background, and in the foreground is Lewis Hamilton dressed in a white suit. He is now at Ferrari. Moving along then to the first article from 10 questions. Let's see if there really are 10 questions here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Diana Taurasi, T-A-U-R-A-S-I, the WNBA's all-time leading scorer, discusses her decision to retire from basketball. Lessons from Russia, what she will miss about the game. This is in the question-answer format. What is your legacy? Every answer, every opportunity I got to play basketball, I took advantage of, whether it was overseas, Olympic team, WNBA, college, high school. At the end of the day, the work and being able to compete, those are the things I love the most out of anything. Those are the only things that resonate with me. What was the moment you knew it was time to retire from basketball after 20 seasons with the Phoenix Mercury? Answer, I start my preseason workouts January 1. I really dial in. I just didn't have it in me. That was pretty much when I knew it was time to walk away. Question, how are you feeling about the decision? Answer, mentally and physically, I am just full. That's probably the best way I can describe it. I am full and I am happy. Question, do you think you're the greatest women's basketball player of all time? Answer, I have a resume. It is not up to me to grade it. Question, you have scored more points than any other player in WNBA history and also hold the record for most Olympic titles won by a basketball player. Do you think those records are safe? Answer, my scoring record or the 6 gold medals, someone's going to come around that has the same hunger, the same addiction to basketball, and put those records in a different way, a different name. That's what sport is all about. That's going to be fun to watch, hopefully not too soon. Question, going back to your childhood in Southern California, what drew you to basketball? Answer, as a little kid, being a kid of immigrants coming to this country, basketball always made me feel a part of something. It always made me feel comfortable. It brought me to a place where, you know, I could love others. I could love myself. It really is to me the one thing that always loved me back. Question, you won 3 WNBA championships in 2007, 2009, and 2014. Were any of those the most important or transformative? Answer, in 07, we were a bunch of kids. We had no goals of winning a championship. Then 09 was just an incredible team. When you win one title, you think you're going to be in the finals every year. That is just not the case. So 2014 and the way we did it, the most wins at the time ever in WNBA history, that just said a lot about what we were building and Phoenix. Question, you spent WNBA off-seasons playing overseas in Turkey and Russia. Now with new opportunities like Unrivaled, the 3-on-3 Women's Hoops League in Miami that launched in January, many players no longer have to leave home to make more money. Do you wish you had such opportunities? Answer, if you asked the 22-year-old me, would you rather play in Moscow or Miami, I think I would have picked Miami. But you asked the 42-year-old me. In those 12 years I spent overseas, especially the 10 I spent in Russia, I learned lessons that you cannot learn anywhere else. It made me know I can live anywhere in the world with anyone, get along with any type of person, whether there was a language barrier, a mindset barrier, a political barrier, you name it, you had to make it work. I'm really grateful I got to do that. Question, so what is next? Answer, that's the question I still don't have an answer for. I really enjoy taking my kids to school, being home when they're home, not leaving for a week at a time. Question, what are you going to miss most? Answer, I'm going to miss the competition. I'm going to miss trying to get better every single off season. I'm going to miss the bus rides, shoot arounds. I'm going to miss the inside jokes. I'm going to miss the locker room, the things that come with being on a basketball team. All those things I will deeply miss. Sean Gregory wrote that article featuring Diana Taurasi. Time off reviews, movies. Spy spouses face a potential breach of trust. This is by Stephanie Zakarik. Familiarity breeds contempt, maybe especially in marriages. How do you keep a close partnership fresh? Perhaps married spies, like the ones in Steven Soderbergh's silky spy caper, Black Bag, have the answer. George Woodhouse, Michael Fassbender, an experienced operative at Britain's National Cybersecurity Center, receives a list of 5 colleagues who are suspected of being moles, capable of activating a cyber worm designed to wreak nuclear havoc. No problem there, except his wife, fellow high-level spy Catherine St. Jean, or St. John, it's spelled J-E-A-N, Kate Blanchett, to whom he's devoted, is on the list. The trust between the two is unshakable. George is not too worried. His first move is to invite the other 4 suspects to the couple's house for dinner, the better to ferret out the traitor. Avoid the Shana Masala, he casually informs his preternaturally self-possessed wife as she slips into a column of liquid charmeuse before the guests arrive. He's dosed that particular dish with truth serum, the better to get tongues flapping around the dinner table. The potential traitors, played by Tom Burke, Naomi Harris, Reja Jean Page, and Marissa Abella, also happen to be 2 sets of couples, because, as one of them laments, who else can a spy really date? But if the party, a chic gathering around a low-lit table in the couple's Architectural Digest-ready London abode, yields some juicy cyber-spy gossip, this is a crowd who will tell you what they really think of Edward Snowden. It does not tell George much about what his wife might be up to. The 2 talk about their work at home, but only up to a point. Any question too delicate to answer is met with a 2-word code intended politely to get the other to back off, Black Bag. And that's the response George gets when he asks Catherine about some troubling evidence he finds post-party while emptying the trash. This is a spy spouse who not only does all the cooking, but also all the tidying up. Meanwhile, Catherine purrs an invitation from the bedroom. George may be wild about her, but His trust in her is shaken. The great thing about the way Soderbergh makes movies, generally swiftly and for relatively few pennies, is that he seems to have a great deal of fun doing it. The result is that his pictures don't feel fussy or over-serious. That's Black Bag in a Satin Gold nutshell. The script is by David Koepp, writer of the best Mission Impossible, the 1996 Brian De Palma iteration, and it is filled with shimmery red herrings and liberal lashings of phony baloney technology spy stuff. One agent compliments the work of another with buttery superlatives. It's a very sexy piece of code. The picture's sultry and understated, almost like a Sada song in movie form, though in some ways that's a liability. Black Bag is over before you feel you've really gotten a hold of it. Maybe it's more of an amuse-bouche rather than a whole meal. But then, would you rather have a well-crafted little morsel served up on a perfect porcelain square, or a heaping plateful of mashed nonsense that bores you before you're even finished? Black Bag succeeds on its chilly wit and on the cool, nervy appeal of its two stars. Blanchett strides through the movie with lioness grace. Fassbender makes George's robotic use of logic seem like an aphrodisiac. Like all married couples, George and Catherine have their things, those little daily annoyances, the occasional doubt about what the other may be thinking or doing in their private hours. But in the clinch, they are a united front. What God hath joined, let no man put asunder. That goes for pesky little cyberworms, too. The brief news. Nation. How Trump's cuts are hurting his voters, by Alana Samuels. Clarksburg, West Virginia, has lead pipes scattered throughout the city, which has caused elevated levels of lead in some children's blood, resulting in health issues like developmental delays. In 2023, the Environmental Justice Division of the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, introduced a new program designed to increase lead testing for local children and families so officials could catch elevated lead levels early and prevent long-term health complications. Partnering with cash-strapped state agencies, the EPA bought kits that could measure lead levels in children with just a finger prick, gave out gift cards to incentivize testing, offered testing opportunities in offices where families picked up benefits and received breastfeeding support. The program invested $150,000 in lead testing kits for Harrison County, where Clarksburg is located, which raised testing rates in children from about 8% to 41%, says Camilla Millenhout, Director of Women, Infant, and Children, WIC, Nutrition, in six West Virginia counties, including Harrison. Children with high levels of lead were then targeted for health interventions, like dietary changes that would reduce their risk of long-term problems. The future of the program is now uncertain because of the Trump administration's focus on rooting out efforts to prioritize diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI, and environmental justice initiatives. A proposed expansion of the lead testing program to states like Ohio is also threatened. An EPA staffer connected to the initiative was put on administrative leave in early February as part of the Trump administration's purge of federal government workers. An additional 167 members of the EPA's Office of Environmental Justice and External Civil Rights were put on administrative leave, according to the agency, after receiving emails that said they were identified as spending more than half their time on environmental justice initiatives. These moves were part of President Trump's executive order titled Ending Radical and Waste Government DEI Programs and Preferencing, which he issued his first day in office to target DEI and environmental justice programs. A Maryland judge, February 21, largely blocked the administration from carrying out much of the DEI executive order, though staff members and recipients of grants have not yet seen changes since then. The administration's goal, it said, was to slash spending and end initiatives that single out minorities for help. In the directive, Trump criticized his predecessor's own executive order, seeking to advance racial equity and support for underserved communities, as illegal and immoral discrimination. New EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin said in a video posted on X February 12 that the days of irresponsibly shoveling boatloads of cash to far-left activist groups in the name of environmental justice and climate equity are over. He added on February 22, update, I just canceled another 21 wasteful DEI and environmental justice grants with the help of our amazing DOGE team, racking up $67 million more in savings. But many of the environmental justice programs targeted by the new administration's staff cuts and funding freezes do not benefit minorities or left-leaning environmental groups, according to Adam Ortiz, who until January served as the EPA's regional administrator for Region 3, which includes Pennsylvania, Virginia, and West Virginia. Often they help poor white communities in conservative areas, places that overwhelmingly voted for Trump. Clarksburg, a beneficiary of the West Virginia lead testing program, is a former manufacturing hub that is 90% white and has a poverty rate of 23.2%, about double the national average. Harrison County, where it is located, voted for Trump by a margin of 40 percentage points in 2024. These are communities that had the most hope in this administration and are now feeling the most suffering, says Jacob Israel Hanna, the CEO of Coalfield Development Corporation, a nonprofit that does workforce development in 21 counties in West Virginia. Coalfield had won nearly $700 million in federal funding for projects across the region, but nearly all that money was frozen by federal spending pauses targeting DEI, environmental justice, and clean energy initiatives. When asked about the idea that ending DEI and environmental justice activities hurts communities that supported Trump, an EPA spokesperson said in a statement to Time, it is working diligently to implement President Trump's executive orders. It placed the 168 Office of Environmental Justice employees on administrative leave after EPA career staffers determined their functions did not relate to the agency's statutory duties, the statement said. The agency is in the process of evaluating new structure and organization to ensure we are meeting our mission of protecting human health and the environment for all Americans, according to the statement. Harrison Fields, a White House spokesman, wrote in an email to Time, protecting the civil rights and expanding opportunities for all Americans is a key priority of the Trump administration, which is why he took decisive actions to terminate unlawful DEI preferences. One of the grants Coalfield Development Corporation won, worth around $130 million, would have created 1,000 new jobs by training unemployed coal workers to become solar installers and then to install 250 megawatts of solar on closed coal mines, says Hanna. But now, he says, when Coalfield staffers log into funding portals for the Department of Energy, the EPA, and the Department of Labor, they receive a message that their grants are under review and they're not able to access the money they were promised. The grant applications included the term environmental justice because they would have helped underserved communities access jobs and clean power, Hanna says. If the grant goes away, you'll see the loss of what would have been over 1,000 new jobs in Appalachia, Hanna says. While some of the beneficiaries of environmental justice projects have been low-income communities of color in cities, others are struggling white communities in Appalachia. The Biden administration mandated 40% of many of its climate and clean energy funds flow to disadvantaged communities that are marginalized by underinvestment and overburdened by pollution. The important thing to understand about all the grants at the EPA is that they prioritized reaching the communities most overburdened by pollution, says Zeelan Hoover, who was until recently the director of implementation at the EPA, overseeing $100 billion in funding. In every state, there was a wide range of communities receiving funding. That includes rural communities in the Southeast and Gulf Coast, and places across the country that have disproportionately high energy costs, Hoover says. Some of the programs whose funding was paused or whose federal staff were placed on administrative leave provided access to clean drinking water and functioning wastewater treatment plants, says Ortiz, the former EPA regional administrator. One project, spearheaded by a staffer now on administrative leave, sought to relocate a wastewater treatment plant in Richwood, West Virginia, that has been basically inoperable since a 2016 flood, he says. Our environmental justice work was really focused on places that historically did not have the ability to match funds or pay loans back, Ortiz says. For the first time since the 1930s and 1940s, these communities were receiving serious investments to rebuild critical infrastructure. In Pennington Gap, Virginia, which is located in a county where 86% of voters supported Trump in 2024, the future of a grant to demolish an asbestos-filled grocery store, issued through the EPA's Environmental Justice Collaborative Problem-Solving Cooperative Agreement Program, is now in question. The nonprofit environmental group Appalachian Voices, which received the grant, cannot get in touch with its EPA program lead and cannot send out any more information to community members without EPA approval, says Emma Kelly, new economy program coordinator for Appalachian Voices. Many of the EPA environmental justice staffers put on leave are eager to get back to work, even in an administration hostile to the work they do. No economy is going to be restored, says one staffer on administrative leave, who asked not to be named because they hope to be reinstated, if you do not have sanitation or clean drinking water. Next page, the brief news. Good question. What are abortion shield laws? By Chantel Lee. In the aftermath of the U.S. Supreme Court decision overturning Roe v. Wade in 2022, many states have moved to protect the right to abortion, and several have turned to a new tool to do so. abortion shield laws. Enacted in 18 states and Washington, D.C., abortion shield laws are novel protections, according to Lizzie Hinckley, senior state legislative counsel at the Center for Reproductive Rights, which helped draft some of them. The laws are meant to protect providers practicing in states where abortion is legal from civil and criminal actions taken by states with bans or restrictions on abortion. The laws also cover patients and people who help a patient access abortion. The protections vary by state, but can include the shield state's refusal to comply with another state's extradition order for a doctor who has provided reproductive health care that is legally protected in the shield state, and refusal to participate in another state's investigation into the provider. This is new territory, Hinckley says. Shield laws were a tool that states have been using in response to a change in how abortion rights are treated in the country. When there was still a federal protected right to abortion, states did not have to be concerned about whether a provider in their state was going to be criminalized for providing abortion care to a patient or resident of another state, because states could not criminalize that care. There was a right to abortion. There were guardrails that were federally protected. Of the 18 states that have shield laws, 8 of them, including New York, provide protections for doctors who prescribe abortion pills through telemedicine to patients in other states, according to Rachel Rebouchet, dean and professor at Temple University Beasley School of Law. About 63% of all abortions in the formal American healthcare system in 2023 were medication abortions, but anti-abortion activists and lawmakers have been attempting to restrict access to the pills. After the Supreme Court overturned Roe, the Biden administration made efforts to increase access to abortion pills by allowing them to be prescribed via telehealth and received via mail. But reproductive rights advocates are concerned the Trump administration will roll back those efforts. Hinckley says telemedicine abortion has been a lifeline for many people who live in states that have banned or restricted abortion. Now, shield laws are being tested through 2 legal challenges in Texas and Louisiana. The Attorney General of Texas, which has a near-total abortion ban, filed a civil suit against New York-based Dr. Margaret Daly Carpenter in December for allegedly prescribing via telemedicine abortion pills to a woman in the state. February 13, a Texas judge ordered Carpenter to stop prescribing abortion pills to Texas residents and to pay a fine of more than $100,000. Carpenter and her lawyers did not respond to the lawsuit, given New York's shield law, which bars cooperating with other states' investigations into providers. Louisiana, which also has a near-total abortion ban, charged Carpenter with a felony for allegedly prescribing abortion pills to a pregnant minor there. New York Governor Kathy Hochul said February 13 she will not extradite Carpenter to Louisiana, not now, not ever, per New York's shield law. Louisiana cannot prosecute Carpenter unless she is physically present in court, according to Rebouchet. It is the first time shield laws have been tested in court. I think they point to what we can expect moving forward for intense interstate conflict, Rebouchet says. The standoff between New York and the 2 other states will likely proceed to federal courts. Rebouchet thinks the cases could end up at the U.S. Supreme Court. Hinckley says the intent of the legal challenges is to scare doctors who are providing abortion care, but that shield laws are working to provide access to people across the country. She expects more legal threats to the laws. But I can say with certainty that SHIELD laws were drafted with good care and with these legal challenges in mind, and they stand on solid ground, both within what states are allowed to do as well as what they are not allowed to do, she says. For a few minutes, I will read what is probably the lead story, Horsepower, about the featured person on the cover, Lewis Hamilton, in the white suit. There's a double page, two pages, photograph. Driving force. With his move to Ferrari, Lewis Hamilton aims to cement his status as Formula One's greatest athlete ever by Sean Gregory, London, and Maranello, Italy. This is another portrait of, what's his name? Hamilton, Lewis Hamilton. This time he's wearing black. Photographed in London in February with Aroma the Stallion. The photography is by Skanderbergs for Time. Well, this black stallion is definitely dominant in this two-page photo shoot. Gregory's the author. Lewis Hamilton is dwarfed by this beautiful black stallion named Aroma. Again, this is a lengthy article, and I'm going to read just a couple of paragraphs from it. All right. On Valentine's Day, Lewis Hamilton enters a sprawling studio space in northwest London and intently stares at the magnificent creature standing off in the distance. SH space T, says Hamilton to no one in particular. I'm nervous. Soon enough, however, the seven-time Formula One world champion overcomes his anxiety and is standing face-to-face with a shiny black stallion named Aroma. He pets his nose, massages his neck, generally spreads his hands all over Aroma's thick coat. He's doing his allergies, the source of his initial fear. No favors. But Hamilton, a literal knight, is enamored, peppering the horse master with questions. Where's Aroma from? Portugal. Can he sleep lying down? Yes. How much does he weigh? About 1,300 pounds, only a few hundred less than Hamilton's race car. He's throwing health caution to the wind in order to commemorate his much ballyhooed move from Mercedes, where he won six of his seven F1 driver titles, to the venerated Scuderia Ferrari HP race team. A photo of himself positioned in front of an actual black horse, standing on his hind legs, mimicking an Italian automaker's famous logo. Like Hamilton, Aroma, who's retired but still does the occasional photo shoot, has an impressive resume, including appearances in Robin Hood and Maleficent, ads for Hermes and Burberry, and a Dua Lipa video. He is joined by Theo, a stunt horse you might recognize from Bridgerton, among other things. This is going to be such an iconic picture, says Hamilton while trying on outfits for the shoot. Super timeless. That depends, of course, on what comes after. At 40, Hamilton's aiming to not only win a record 8th F1 driver title, cementing his status as the greatest F1 driver to ever live and ending the longest ever championship drought for the most storied race team on the planet, but also fulfill a lifelong dream. His move to Ferrari, announced before the 2024 season, was shocking worldwide front page news. He had suited up for Mercedes for more than a decade, helped build a more diverse workforce there, and hoped to someday acquire an ownership stake in the team. It seemed he would ride into the sunset with the silver arrows. Hamilton had other ideas. You can't stand still for too long, Hamilton tells Time in his first in-depth interview about his decision to leave Mercedes for Ferrari. I needed to throw myself into something uncomfortable again. Honestly, I thought all my firsts were done. Your first car, your first crash, your first date, first day of school. The excitement I got by the idea of, this is my first time in the red suit. The first time in the Ferrari. Wow. Honestly, I've never been so excited. I'm severely abridging this article now, heading to the last three paragraphs. Hamilton is predicting box office success. It is going to blow away anything that's ever been done in Formula One before, Hamilton says. The Netflix behind-the-scenes docuseries, Formula One, Drive to Survive, has been properly credited for expanding F1's popularity, especially in the U.S. Hamilton believes this movie will compel viewers from all different backgrounds to become fans or even pursue a career in F1. Netflix has been huge, he says. This is going to be even bigger, on more of a global scale. While F1 might not count as art house fare, I don't think we set out for it to be like an Oscar-winning movie, says Hamilton. He's promising a memorable experience. The goal is to make people feel good, to bring people in, to inspire people, he says. We want you to leave the cinema and be like, wow, that was freaking wicked. But even with his creative juices flowing, he's as energized as ever to drive. In other words, unlike Aroma, whose presence does not seem to have triggered Hamilton's allergies at all, he has no plans to slow down. What I can tell you is, retirement is nowhere on my radar, says Hamilton. I could be here till I'm 50. Who knows? Hamilton believes he and Leclerc are the strongest team pairing in the sport, and that Verstappen is absolutely beatable. I know exactly where the North Star is, says Hamilton. I know where I need to go. I know how to get there. It's far, and it's going to be tough to get there, but I know I've got all the ingredients, all the people, an amazing team around me, so it's how much you want it, and I can't express to you how much I want it. The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer, Iran avoids talks and moves toward the bomb. Since Donald Trump's election victory in November, Iran has sharply accelerated its uranium enrichment program. That does not mean Iran is sprinting toward the finish line in building a nuclear weapons program, but it still represents a threat. The International Atomic Energy Agency, the world's nuclear watchdog, says 42 kilograms of uranium enriched to 60% purity is needed to produce a weapon, and Iran is now hitting that mark each month. If its entire stockpile were enriched to 90%, it would have enough weapons-grade uranium for 6 nuclear bombs. A diplomatic push to contain this threat will not be easy. First, Iran's leaders have reason to believe a nuclear weapons capability has become essential for its defense. Its most heavily armed ally in the region, Lebanon's Hezbollah, has taken a crippling blow from Israel in recent months. Iran's ability to resupply the group was made vastly more complicated by the collapse of the Assad regime in Syria, the primary route for arms, and the last Tehran-friendly government in the Middle East. Hamas, another Iranian ally, will need years to rebuild after Israel's assault on Gaza, and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has taken aggressive military action against Israel's other regional enemies. In addition, Iran's leaders are reluctant to negotiate with the Trump administration from an obvious point of weakness, with little confidence that Trump is willing to cut an acceptable deal. Though Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian's administration and the regime's more pragmatic conservatives lean toward engagement with Washington, Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has called direct negotiations with Trump unwise, unintelligent, not honorable. The forced resignation of Vice President Mohammad Javad Zarif, chief negotiator of the 2015 nuclear deal, and Iran's most prominent reformist, signaled hardliners are firmly in the driver's seat and underscored the stiffening of Tehran's stance. Talks with European governments are already underway, and Arab states could offer Iran new trade and investment opportunities. But any communication between Tehran and Washington will pass through Arab and European intermediaries, and soon through Moscow, now that Russian President Vladimir Putin has agreed to Trump's request to help broker talks. In the meantime, Iran's leaders know the country's nuclear program remains vulnerable to attack. Israel's direct strikes on Iran last October demonstrate Netanyahu's willingness to cross what were once considered red lines. But any strike on Iran's nuclear sites, which are buried deep underground and heavily reinforced, would require the use of U.S. munitions delivered by American aircraft. Trump's wariness of foreign entanglements is a central part of his appeal for many voters. Though he will continue to use the threat of military action to bolster Washington's bargaining position, Trump remains unlikely to allow Netanyahu to draw U.S. forces into a shooting war for now. Given Iran's weakened economy and diminished regional strength, Tehran will have to make concessions in the coming months. But the sharp acceleration of its uranium enrichment, grounded in the belief only the ultimate weapon can deter U.S. and Israeli attacks, will make bargaining difficult and any comprehensive deal highly unlikely. European governments have already made clear that if Iran does not slow its nuclear progress by summer, snapback sanctions will be triggered. And Iran has vowed to abandon its commitments under the Non-Proliferation Treaty in return. But Iran cannot afford a war with Israel that it cannot win. And though the current risk of U.S. military action is low, that will change over time. Trump does not want to be remembered as the president who let Iran get the bomb. The View essay, subtitled Nation, Return Public Lands to Indigenous People. Photographs and text by Joe Whittle. Since the start of Donald Trump's second term, his administration has fired thousands of federal workers across multiple public lands agencies. The effects of this are vast. It is going to cause immeasurable harm to America's wildest places and devastate the economies built around them. After serving 12 years as a backcountry wilderness ranger for the U.S. Forest Service, I'm convinced there is an alternative. The U.S. needs to return its public lands to Native Americans. It might be the only way to save our wildlands from corporate privatization and destruction and preserve public access to them. There's more than sufficient evidence that the land and all those who value and depend on its well-being would benefit immensely from its return. I have seen it personally as an enrolled tribal member of the Caddo Nation. I was taught by my indigenous elders that nothing's more important than caring for the land, not just because the land also cares for us, but also because we are part of the land. Sustainability begins by following what many indigenous communities refer to as the natural laws. They include principles such as never take more than you need, always leave something for those who come behind, and always give back for what you receive. The laws teach us nature builds order into the ecologies we are part of, and it is our job to follow it no matter how we utilize nature's gifts. They also teach us taking something without reciprocity is an act of violence, but that to receive and give a gift is an act of love. Indigenous people seek to emulate that in our relationships with nature. Our cultures view the natural world as our relatives rather than our resources. This creates reciprocity and sustainability with nature and with one another. If the U.S. will not properly care for its public lands, why not return them to their original caretakers? I will read the captions of these three photographs provided. Native American backpackers in Northeast Oregon's Joseph Canyon stopped to savor their connection with the land during a backpacking trip January 2018. This looks desolate, folks. These mountains upon which the backpackers are standing are brown. Brown and crooked and humpy and bumpy, and the sky in the background is blue. And they're marching through tall grasslands. Then another photograph here is very watery, with mountains in the background topped with snow. Nez Perce canoe carver Alan Pinkham Jr. says the tribe's culture informs their push to remove regional dams that harm fish populations. Well, it looks like he has just felled a big tree, and perhaps that will be his next canoe. He's standing thigh deep in water next to the very large log. In the background, there's a forest of green trees, behind which is another forest of greener trees, and behind that are the gray and white mountains in front of blue sky. And the final photo is apparently the back of a woman. I'll read the caption. The author asked his daughter, River, pictured here in 2018 at Caddo Mound State Historic Site while visiting their homelands for the first time, why she believes in returning public lands. The land needs people who love it and advocate for it, she says. Indigenous people have time-tested knowledge of what that looks like. This appears to be a woman dressed in dark purple with a blue apron. We see the back of her, and she's holding to her head something that looks like a very long ribbon, perhaps with beadwork, but definitely with decorations. She's walking on a level path that looks very much like red dirt to me. On either side are green, grassy green lawns, behind which are trees, behind which is a rose gold purple sky. So she's apparently walking into a sunset. It's really quite elegant. Okay, turning the page now to the View Inbox. This is the DC Brief by Charlotte Alter, senior correspondent. I may need to abridge this. It looks like questions and answers. Jared Golden knows a thing or two about how swing voters think of the Democratic Party. First elected to represent Maine's 2nd Congressional District in 2018, Golden has managed to keep his seat in a red-leaning district that President Donald Trump carried by nearly 10 points in November. Golden predicted Trump's victory, and the self-described progressive conservative has a message of tough love for his fellow Democrats. Okay, questions and answers coming up. Can you give us your brief take on what went wrong for the Democrats and why? Answer, President Biden ran as someone who was going to kind of bring the norm back, right? And by the time he took office, it was like a swapped narrative, where it was not a return to normalcy, but instead a mandate for revolutionary change. And he was going to be the next FDR. I think it was a misreading of the mandate that's been given to the party from voters. Question. What's the message you have for your party? Let's see, this guy's a Democrat. Answer, I think the party is as weak as I've ever seen it. a lot of people are talking about our need to win back the working class, and there seems to be a growing consensus that it is not as it was described in 2017 as a white working class problem, but rather as a working class problem. And while we're searching for answers about how to re-engage with working class people, perhaps we should not start by attacking something President Trump is putting forward that is broadly popular with the working class, which is tariffs. I think that for working class people that live in communities that have been on the losing side of globalization and free trade, that is a stand-in for letting them know we hear you. We see the effect of 20, 30, 40 years of policy, and we're committed and open-minded to trying things to fix it. As one of the only Democrats left representing an Obama-Trump district, what do you wish your party understood about your voters? Answer, my district went Obama in 08, Obama in 12, Trump in every presidential election since. My perspective is that there are still a lot of swing voters, even though the national narrative is that there are none. I don't think that either party is loved by a lot of these voters. So anyone that suggests that the pathway forward is to just kind of turn our back on voters like those that I represent is wrong. They're very much up for grabs, but not if we're out there saying we are not interested. I've worked really hard to establish trust with people, and I think as a result I have some leeway for people to say, I don't agree with Jared on this one particular issue, but I trust him in general. Early on in my time here in Congress, people were telling me, you'll never get Trump supporters to support you. You can try, but it will never bear fruit. I kind of rejected the premise that you just have to play to your base. If you could remake your party in a way that would appeal to the swing voters who elected you, what would that party be? Answer, there's a lot of things about the Democratic Party that are very good and that play very strongly with the American electorate. The Democratic Party is the party of the New Deal, and we should stay committed to that. That's a way of saying Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. I think part of the problem of the moment is the New Deal contract with the American people has been eroding. And instead of focusing on piecing it back together and strengthening it, we're often trying to talk about new things. So let's double down on our past commitments to the American people. We're going to make sure you have a secure retirement. We're going to make sure you have affordable health care. I am very pro-union, and I think that is key to my success and key to the well-being of the country as a counterbalance to economic forces. But I've started taking a slightly different tone than in the past. I will say we should tax the rich to reduce the deficit. The state of our budget and our debt is bad for the country and bad for working families. I am just acknowledging that. It seems like a lot of people in the Democratic Party want to brush that aside. What should be the core that the party rebuilds itself around? Answer, we need big reform, not tinkering around the edges. I think we should get serious about class, use that as our starting place, and then ask ourselves, which class do we want to represent? My thesis would be the working class. They live everywhere. We have to go compete everywhere. We have to find new candidates. I think we should think really long and hard about who we are recruiting and why. We have to ask ourselves hard questions about what we're putting forward that's not popular and be willing to back off of those things. We should ask, what's the Republican Party putting forward that is? And maybe we should make those things ours. And the final question, what does progressive conservative actually mean? Answer, I personally reject the whole left-right debate. I reject words like centrist or moderate. I do not think those terms really mean much to voters. I think about things very much along class lines. I think the party has obviously been judged on being very focused on identity politics, and I think that cuts up the working class rather than unifying it. At its core, it is about nuance and attention to details, getting it right, unshackling yourself from a loyalty to ideology. Instead, loyalty to place in representation, not just of the people that voted for you, but everyone you represent. Here's a photo of Jared Golden, dressed in a blue suit, white shirt, blue tie. Always standing in front of what I would consider a blurry photograph of the Capitol Dome. He has short hair. I call it a crew cut. Brown. Brown eyes. Brown facial hair. Maine Democrat Jared Golden at a bipartisan House event, March 6. He's staring straight ahead, askance from the camera, with his arms folded over his chest. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.